This Week in Startups is brought to you by SendPro Online from Pitney Bowes. Save time and money no matter what you ship or mail. Try it free for 30 days and get a free 10-pound scale when you visit pb.com/twist. Capterra, the leading free online resource to find your best software solutions. Visit capterra.com/twist for free to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. And Silicon Valley Bank, purpose-built for founders and high-growth startups, Silicon Valley Bank offers banking and financial solutions that fit every stage of the startup journey. Visit svb.com/next to learn more. Silicon Valley Bank, ideas bank here. Upcoming launch events. Apply for the next Launch Accelerator cohort. Applications are due July 18th. Learn more and apply at launchaccelerator.co. You can also apply for our next Founder University, September 9th and 10th in San Francisco at founder.university.
Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of This Week in Startups. As many of you know, I do a lot of events, and I'm fascinated by space, just like Starbucks is. Everybody likes a third space, and that was what Starbucks' success was based on. Not just the coffee your way, but having a space that's not your home and not your work. What is that third space in your life? Some people might say a library, but it's not open that often. Some people might say school. But what Starbucks did so well is they made it very inviting for people who were leaving their homes, but not yet at work, to go to a third space and do whatever they want, have a conversation. That's what cafe culture was all about in Paris, in London, pub culture, Ireland, pub culture, America, you know, maybe burger joints. Third space is an incredibly important concept, and I've been looking for an investment in this space for a long time because I do events. And here's the challenge I have when I do an event. I want to bring together 50 people, and you go to an event planner, or you go to a hotel or a restaurant, and they look at you and say, how much money can we extract? And how complicated can we make this? And you know, the longer it takes for you to get a quote or a price for something, the more you're going to get screwed. This is true of cars. This is true of apartments. This is true of buying a bed, anything where they force you to talk to a salesperson, they force you to pick up the phone. What you want is transparent pricing. And you can never get transparent pricing on an event. When I try to do a 50-person event at a hotel, they say it's $1,500 for the room. They say it's a minimum of $18 for coffee per person, $37 for lunch, $125 for dinner. And then all of a sudden I bring 100 people and it's costing $300 or $400 a person. So annoying, so unnecessary, and it creates so much friction. And then you gotta find the ballroom. When I heard about the idea for Neighborly during our accelerator, the Launch Accelerator, the accelerator run here in San Francisco, when I heard the pitch for Neighborly, I said, why doesn't this exist? And I had that spidey sense, that tingling that as investors occurs when you meet a founder who you know is destined for success with an idea that you say should already exist, but it does not. Today, I'm thrilled to share with you a company I've now invested a couple million bucks in and that I think is destined to become a unicorn in the next 3 or 4 years. Sounds crazy, but this is what we do for a living here at Launch. Welcome to the program, Ben Seidel.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Okay, you heard my introduction.
Yeah, that was lofty. Thank you.
Is that a little bit of a pun there? A little bit of a pun. Tell everybody, what is Neighborly and how does it work?
Yeah, so very quickly, Neighborly is a network of spaces that you can rent by the hour. They are storefronts that have been repurposed into gathering spaces that you can rent for meetings, events, birthday parties, art shows, pop-up retail, you name it. If you need an affordable, convenient space to use in your city, your neighborhood, your community, we've got a space for you.
Okay. What is that hourly rate?
So it depends on the location, but in general, right around $90 to $100 an hour, all in.
Okay. And what is the size of that space, generally speaking? I give you $100. I give you $500 for 5 hours of space. Mm-hmm. What would the space look like and how big would it be? How many people would it fit?
Yeah, in general, it's a ground floor space. It fits around 50 people. It comes included with handcrafted furniture, Amazing interior design. It comes with a little kitchenette. It comes with appliances like a fridge.
And so it's a projection. Box.
It's a box, basically, but it's got all the things that you might need to put together an event or a meeting in fast fashion and an affordable rate. So we want to make it as frictionless as possible. So all the things that you might need, we've got covered. If you need extras, we've got abilities to add those as well.
But what is the median square foot? You have 5 locations, I believe.
6 now.
Mm-hmm. Have we announced the 6?
Yeah, we just opened the Mission last week.
Okay, and I'm going to be one of the first people to use it.
You are, tomorrow.
So all 6 locations, mm-hmm. Jack London Square, Union Square, The Mission.
Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. And what are the other two?
Berkeley, California.
Oh, Berkeley, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then we've got 2 in Union Square.
And 2 in Union Square. Mm-hmm. Tell me the median and range on a square footage basis of these spaces.
Yeah, so what we shoot for on average is around 1,700 square feet. That's a perfect size for us.
1,700 square feet.
Yeah, so it fits 50 really well, both seated and standing. And what we found is that recipe of square footage and location really works well for people, because you've got people always ask, what's the difference between this and all the other venues out there? Well, most of these venues are set up to be 200 to 400 person places for big weddings,
yes,
big corporate conferences, you name it. There's
and
a lot of spaces.
They're usually buried somewhere in a hotel, down an escalator, up and to the right, and it takes you 10 minutes after you enter the hotel to find it.
100%.
And when you do find it, it's a dark, ugly, smelly rug room, mm-hmm. With bad lighting.
Yep. So
yours are all storefronts on, I would say, active or somewhat active streets.
Yep.
Easily accessible streets. Is that correct?
Yep. And they're all ground floor, so you should be able to just walk right in off the street. Loading, unloading is really easy. Having your attendees find a space, very simple. You know, you don't have to have some kind of lobby person or some kind of security process to get people in. It's in and out. And so it just makes it really convenient and accessible.
By the way, that's another place that hotels and event spaces gouge you on.
Yep.
You negotiate a price for a 2-day event, and then they go, oh yeah, I need $6,000 for load-in day. And you're like, what? And they're like, yeah, you rented the space for $40,000. Now we want to charge you another $6,000 to bring your stuff in.
Yeah.
Or you can bring your stuff in at 6 a.m., 2 hours before your guests arrive, which is impossible. So here, the load-in is super easy because you're at street mm-hmm. level.
Yep.
Additionally, if you're at street level, it's easy for your guests to find it. It's yep. as easy to find as a Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just type in the address and you're right there.
So easy. You
know. So that's a big part of kind of why we look for these types of spaces. And instead of kind of copying what the traditional event industry has always done with these massive spaces and gouging you on catering and beverages and services. And, you know, when we first had, our very first location was 700 square feet and tiny. It was in West Berkeley in the middle of nowhere. And Amazon called us at one point, and I thought it was some kind of hoax. I thought they were trying to sell us something. And they were actually inquiring about booking our space. And we'd only been open for 3 months and had, I think, 9 events at that point.
What are the most common events right now, if you were to rank the top 3 in order of usage of the first 6 Neighborly, and so people know the spelling, it's NeyBorly.com, correct? Mm-hmm. Or do we have the .co or .com?
.com.
Okay, great. So it's Ney, Ney, Borley. Mm-hmm. Got it. What are the top 3 in order uses of the spaces to date?
So to date, it is offsite meetings. It is, I would say, family gatherings, so that ranges from birthday parties to kids' parties to
family
type things. And then I would say the third most popular usage of the space is some type of like pop-up retail, art show, activation. So people doing some type of thing to come together around commerce or art. Yeah.
All right, when we get back from this quick break, I want to talk about the economics here. What it costs to rent a place, and the destruction of retail. Because it seems to me that Neighborly's ascension is a possible solution to the death of retail. We have so many retail spaces. I want to know if I'm correct or not when we get back on This Week in Startups. You are a busy founder, and I don't want you wasting your time and money trying to find the best rate for postage and to send your packages. I want you to use SendPro Online from Pitney Bowes. With that product, you're going to be able to send packages in mail right from your desk for as low as, wait for it, $4.99. No, not $499, $4.99. Less than you pay for a pour-over coffee here in San Francisco. No matter what you need to send, packages, overnights, letters, just click and save and use this offer for Send Pro Online. Only $4.99 a month. You go to pb.com/twist, PB as in Pitney Bowes, pb.com/twist, and you will get a free 30-day trial plus a free 10-pound scale, so you're not wasting any money. You can track your shipments, get email notifications. You're going to gain access to the U.S. Postal Service's savings for letters and priority mail shipping. If you don't know what that is, you'll find out. It's going to save you a bundle. And you can easily compare rates using their online software. Of course, you can print the labels and stamps from your own printer. You know that. That's table stakes today. So I want you to go get that free 30-day trial and the scale at pb.com/twist. pb.com/twist. You need to be efficient. You need to use the mail, obviously, and sometimes that can be super inefficient if you have to go to the post office. Now you get the post office in your office. Experience the better way to ship with a free trial to Send Pro Online from Pitney Bowes. Please go save time and go save money and put it into your business. Thanks again to Send Pro Online from Pitney Bowes for supporting This Week in Startups. I truly and personally appreciate it. Okay, let's get back to this episode. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. My guest is Ben Seidel. He is the co-founder and CEO of Neighbourly, which we met because you applied to the accelerator, correct?
No, actually before that, I went to your workshop.
You went to Founder University?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, yes, now I remember.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, Founder University is a two-day program we do for free for 60 founders who have a product in market but have yet to raise a big Series A. And that Jackie Deegan, who is the producer of This Week in Startups and our managing director of education, she picks the companies. It's founder.university for those of you wondering the URL, because there's a .university extension.
I'm sure there is.
So you came to that.
Yep.
What was it like to go to Founder University?
Yeah. So I'll be quite candid here because we are on a podcast and I'm with the JCal.
Yeah.
So I might as well be candid.
Yeah. It's our social contract. It's always candid.
Yes. At that point. So our business had been around for a year and a half at that point, and we were raising pre-seed funding. And so I had talked to 30 to 40 investors. I don't have a strong network myself. I'm not from the Bay Area. I'm not a previous founder. So it was really tough for me to build that network to raise that initial capital. And so I was striking out, quite frankly. It was really tough to get into the rooms, get in front of the right people. And I was kind of almost on my last leg, like feeling like I had pitched 40 people. They were all no's, you know. I didn't really know what the future
held. And you got cold introductions to them. You just emailed them.
A couple warm introductions, but a lot of cold stuff. And
a lot
so,
of cold emails, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't have a network. And so one of my, someone we had been working with who was helping us develop some of the software was like, hey, I know about this workshop that they're putting on in San Francisco. It's run by Jason Calacanis. I've worked with him on a previous thing. You should check it out. And so I applied just on a whim. I didn't know what it was all about, but I knew that it was a chance to get some expert level guidance on fundraising and for specifically for companies that were at our stage.
Yeah.
And so to be quite honest, there were probably on my list of fundraising options, this was one of the last things I had.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, I'll go to this couple day thing. Maybe I'll meet somebody there. Who knows?
Yeah.
Like this is worth taking a chance on. So I went to that and didn't really know what to expect. And there were 59 other founders there from with companies in market
in your
with
stage.
Revenue in our stage, doing very well, doing exciting things. A lot of them are multiple time founders. And so it was just a great group of people. And I thought, well, what are the chances of me walking out of here with some pathway to funding? Probably pretty low. And you mentioned it in the room. I mean, it was like, you were only going to fund or even invite to next conversations two or three of the 60 founders that were in that room.
Usually we confer, we usually will have 10%, six go on to apply to the accelerator or going to diligence. And maybe of those, half of them or a third of them will then get invited actually to the accelerator.
So I did the mental math and I was like, well, chances are still low, but at least I'm in the room.
Yeah.
And so that's how I came across launch and what you guys are up to and met you and got the opportunity to pitch you for 2 minutes.
What was my reaction when you pitched?
I'll never forget it. You took your cell phone and you just turned it over on its face and slammed it on the table and said, this is going to be big. This
really?
This is going to have network effects like Uber is what you said.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were like two, three coffees deep or Coke Zeros in your case, but yeah. You were excited about it.
And absolutely.
So your reaction after only a 1.5 minute pitch
right.
was stronger than any other reaction I had gotten from That's any other early stage investor. So
it's instructive to pause for a second here. Because you've learned, I think, this having gone through the 12-week, you went from the 2-week Founder University program to the 12-week accelerator program, mm-hmm. and you've gone through the 2-day mm-hmm. Founder University, yep. the 12-week accelerator, and you've also done the syndicate.
Yep.
So it's important to pause for a second and just think about numbers, I think, for founders. You met with 40, and you got 40 no's on your own. And then you went to an event with 60 people, of which... let's say we invest in typically 3, which is 5%, a 1 in 20 chance. And you were one of the 1 in 20. It's instructive for founders to understand these statistics. You don't need to get everybody. Hmm. You need only get 1.
Yep.
And then 1 can become 2, and 2 can become 6, and 6 can become 600 investors. It literally goes that mm-hmm. way. And really, it's that first domino to fall that is so important for founders. And I think it's very candid of you to say you were thinking of packing it in.
Yeah.
And it's very important for people to realize that investors know less than you, in many cases, about why your business is going to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them just don't get it. I am introduced famously at Open Angel Forum, which was another event I had created about 10 years ago. I introduced 22 people to Uber, and 3 of us invested. Siam Bannister, first round, and myself. There were 19 other people who didn't. And then there's that famous Airbnb, which is an interesting corollary to talk about. Airbnb did a blog post. I think they said they invested, they went to meet with 37 and got 37 no's. It's exactly where mm-hmm. you are. Let's fast forward to you got the $100,000 from us, and you came to the accelerator. Mm-hmm. Tell the audience what the accelerator interview process was like, as candidly as you can. We didn't prearrange for me to, you know, lean it either way, but tell us what that process was like.
You can still do that if you want to.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Tell everybody. It's awesome. No, I like the idea of it being candid, yeah. and then we'll go on to what the candid experience of the accelerator and what you got out of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So because I had already got to know the team mostly through Founder University, it did feel a lot more comfortable for me to be able to come in and start that launch accelerator application process. So I had already pitched you guys one time before, so I felt confident that you had interest in this idea.
Yep.
And I was comfortable with who was going to be in the room. So I did have, in some sense, a shortcut, not necessarily a shortcut, but at least a head start.
You were coming in hot.
Yeah, I was coming in hot. I had some rapport already. And so I knew what I had to kind of shore up in my pitch. Mm. And I knew what you guys saw as potential gaps that I needed to address in the yep. pitch and where I needed to come strong. And so, I came in, did the on-site interview here at the headquarters.
Yep. And so you interviewed with who?
With DeMont and another one of the founders from a previous launch cohort.
Great.
And did that for a day. And then I came back in. I think you got snowed in Tahoe.
I did. Yeah. There was an avalanche there were 2 blizzards in Tahoe, and I hit both of them and got delayed both times by a day or 2. And on the way back, we were driving back, and there was a literal avalanche, and they stopped traffic for 5 hours. So we just went and had lunch. And I was like literally in touch with my team. So DeMont.
That happens every time you go to Tahoe, right?
It's happened twice. So if you ever want to have good skiing, just go when I go. Watch my Twitter.
I did
Jason
that.
Jason DeMont is the managing director of the accelerator, to be clear. And so you met with him. You met with some founders.
Yep.
What did the, and this is, I think, very instructive for founders who are listening, the best way to determine if you should go to an accelerator is to talk to multiple people who have already graduated from that program. Do not take the word of the people who run the program. And in this
accurate.
Case, that's me and DeMont and my team.
Yeah,
I'm saying
accurate.
Don't take our word for it.
Yeah.
Take the word of the people who graduated mm-hmm. and really drill into them. So what did they tell you? And then how did that match up with reality? And we'll go to day one of the accelerator next.
Yeah. So I only had an opportunity to talk to them for a little bit, but I did ask questions as far as like the stage that we were at with the traction that we had been experiencing thus far. What kind of value could I expect to get out of launch? What would they be addressing that we were weak in at that point? And what I just talked about a second ago was that we really, as a first-time founder, as a first-time executive team, we don't have a lot of connections. And so I was really hoping for the chance to get further connected within this industry and use this as literally a launch pad for the ability to connect to later stage investors and find someone to support us. Sure. And so that's what I was trying to key in the most with the previous launch founders was...
Did you actually get access?
Yeah.
How did that go?
What did this result in as far as your network expansion and access to other investors? And everybody was really high on the idea that because it's a smaller cohort in comparison to a lot of these other incubators in the Bay Area.
We do seven.
The small cohort of seven companies really means that you get high quality access to investors. You get a lot of face-to-face time with people that are really hard to get in front of. Mm. And that was a massive advantage that you guys have over most of these other accelerators.
Yeah.
And so it made sense to me. Obviously, a smaller cohort and getting that many investors that you guys get into the room means that I'm just getting more quality time with these people.
Yeah. So you're 15% of the energy in the room.
Right.
Whereas if you were at an accelerator with 50 or 200, mm-hmm. which are the two other major ones do, I think 50 or 200, you would be either 2% or 50 basis points of the energy in the room.
Yep. Yeah. So that's
a big difference.
That excited me a lot because that's, as a first-time founder, I think that that's super important and can't be overlooked, which is like you don't just need a platform. You need quality time too.
Yeah.
If I'm a second or third-time founder, sure, I just need a platform to people to talk to. But I also, for this stage that we're at, I needed that guidance and that one-on-one time to really talk through some of these things. And so I got the feedback from the other launch founders that this is really what you guys are strongest at. Yeah. And so that made me really excited and wanted me,
We really focus on, I think at the accelerator now, making it the easiest way to raise money for a founder who has a product in market, but doesn't yet have a couple of million dollars invested into the company. So they probably have low hundreds of thousands of dollars in both invested capital and revenue.
Yep, that's what we had. We had 150,000. We only had 100,000 before launch, and then you guys gave us 100. So going into the launch accelerator, we only had 200,000.
And
our run rate was 100,000 a month.
Your run rate for revenue.
Yeah,
which is
for
amazing.
Revenue, at that point.
So how much did you wind up raising coming out of the accelerator?
Yeah, that was an incredible process.
What's the number?
The number was 2.5 million.
Okay, when we get back on This Week in Startups, I want you to explain how you went from almost quitting, packing it in with Neighborly, to getting into the accelerator and getting that 100K from us, that small investment, and then coming out of it a short 3-4 months later with $2.5 million in your bank account when we get back on This Week in Startups. It's time for you to look at your software stack and say, what software am I paying for? That is horrible. That is arduous. That's causing me pain and suffering. And find a better solution. Well, how do you find a better solution? Well, if you want to find a better restaurant, you might go to something like Yelp. If you want to buy a better hotel, you might go to one of the hotel review sites. If you want to, you know, you get the idea. There's review sites. I use Metacritic when I'm trying to figure out what to watch. You might use Rotten Tomatoes. What if there was something like that for software? Well, there is. It's called Capterra. C-A-P-T-E-R-R-A. Capterra is the leading source of free, and it's a free source of all the greatest reviews of enterprise software. Over 750,000 reviews, and these are from real software users who have done the research and struggled to find better software to make your company more efficient and bionic. And you can search more than 700 specific categories of software. Well, for us, we did it here for sales automation software. Here's how it worked. Our CMO, Presh, put this video together for us to look at. You can see he's looking for a new sales automation software, and he searched all the reviews. He set some filters, like the number of employees that the software is best optimized for, which is, you know, typically if you need 10,000 people or 1,000 people using a piece of software for your company, it's going to be a lot different than when you have 1 to 10, right? There's different solutions, simpler ones, complex ones, expensive ones, affordable ones. And Capterra is going to put all that side by side. And you're going to see all those great ratings. You're going to see how good their customer support is, what kind of features and functionality they have, and of course, value for money, because that's what we're all looking for. So we picked one, and we're able to do that super easy. We did a trial, and we picked Pipedrive. My team at one of my companies loved Pipedrive, and Capterra helped us find it. and save us money. So visit Capterra.com/twist for free today. Capterra.com/twist. Software selection simplified. That's all you need to know. Thank you, Capterra. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. Our guest, the co-founder and CEO of Neighbourly. If you haven't tried Neighbourly, I am so excited. I've been using it myself. We've been running the accelerator, and I'll be doing my office hours on the 9th. Is that right? July 9th? Yeah. Oh, is it tomorrow?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll be at the mission tomorrow, the 9th. We're taping this on the 8th, where I'll be doing my office hours for the podcast and also as a front to meet my next investments. You go through the 12-week program. Each week, we bring in about 7 investors who give you candid feedback. We also ask them to vote on their top 3 startups. And that means every week we have a first, second, and third place out of the 7 companies. And we have a total score that we track over the 12 weeks of which companies were voted highest by the investors. I'm sure you know where you ranked 1 through 7. Or do you?
Yeah, number 2.
You were number 2. So out of your cohort, you were the 2nd most voted for,
yep.
Which is great. You can pull that microphone right up.
Yeah, I'm more comfortable.
Yeah. So that's great. Did you start off strong?
No, we started off terribly, actually.
Ah, so in the first couple of weeks, you got no votes or third place votes.
Yeah, we were at the bottom.
Why didn't investors early on at the launch accelerator understand what you were doing? And then what tweaks did you make? And how did you learn about, let's call them, the leaks in your game, as we'd say in poker? You had some leaks in your game.
Of course.
What were the leaks in your game that prevented you from clearing market with the investment community, and then how did you fix them?
Yeah, so I only have my own internal hypothesis of what I think changed. I didn't actually get feedback from the people who invested us afterwards, but what I know to be true is what I changed was that in the first 4 weeks of the accelerator, when I was not scoring very well, I was very much telling a story in a myopic way, just like we take these storefronts, we revitalize them, and then rent them by the hour for events, meetings, and parties. Here are the unit economics. It's profitable. We're growing. We want to make a lot more of these.
Okay.
That was it. That's a fine.
Reasonable.
That's a reasonable.
You describe the business.
It's a straightforward. Completely. Yeah. It makes total sense. It works. But I think what I was failing to do is to capture the imagination of the investors and really allow them to see the vision that I have for where this could go and why it could be a unicorn, why it could be a big business. And so even though I was trying to kind of like basically promote the anti-Silicon Valley startup where this has positive unit economics, this is growing, this is cash flow positive, this makes sense. You know, all the things that you would want to kind of, I guess, pitch a bank probably.
Yeah.
Was the way I was pitching it. And that is the way I had been pitching it in the past because we built this business on bank loans, actually.
Right.
In the beginning.
Wow.
And so I had to kind of like, I had to get out of that mindset of pitching this as a day-to-day kind of myopic business. And I needed to say, this is how it's working now. But this is only step one in a process that is going in this direction to become this type of a business. And we're going to revolutionize the way hospitality works around events. And adding in those last couple slides and taking away some of the more minute details of the business model allowed me to kind of open up the discussion to bring these investors into my head of like where I think this company has the potential to go and why I wake up excited about what we're doing. And so, I wasn't doing that at the beginning. And what I realized is like, if you're not doing that, at least in a slide or two, everyone says you need to do about 10% of that in your pitches to investors. And
the big grand vision.
Yeah, the big grand vision.
This works,
where this is going.
What happens?
And what's exciting about this? Why does this matter?
And what was it? How did you explain it? What's the best way for you to explain how big this could get and how exciting it can be?
Yeah, I spent the last 2 slides talking about, and credit to Aaron, one of the launch founders of FreePlay. He talked to me about the idea of a market network. And I had been kind of like dancing around this idea and never really put it to paper. But the idea really is not just the space. It is going to be a market network in the sense that, and if people want to look into this, I really highly suggest this, but NFX has a lot of research on this concept called the market network. And James Currier, who I spoke with, is one of the idea leads on this. And basically the idea is once you've got the first generation of companies was, you know, we had these marketplaces, we have Airbnb, we've got all these different things that are connecting two-sided marketplaces. And that's great. But you, at some point, and you've got social networks. So you've got something like a Facebook and Instagram. You've got these ways that you're connecting a bunch of people together. Well, the third wave is going to be a hybrid of those two things, which is a marketplace on top of a social network. So you get the stickiness and the retention of a network, and then you add a marketplace on top of it to monetize it. And that's really what I realized that we were doing. And Aaron over Super Duper Burgers
gave me— For people who don't know, the context there is, we don't go do happy hours or other nonsense like that. After the accelerator breaks at like 3:30, we take over a burger joint and we sit there for another hour and kind of debrief and hang out. So during the debrief with Aaron from FreePlay, he said, hey, check out Market Networks, which I just pulled up on the screen. NFX is a great venture firm here that we work with a lot. We don't really compete with them. It's all very collegial in the early stages. But they say that a market network is when you can combine a marketplace, which is transactions among multiple buyers and sellers, with a network, identity and communications. I guess that's like your address book, basically, your social graph, whatever you want to call it, plus workflow, like SaaS tools and software. And when you started presenting it as that, then people believe there could be a viral coefficient and it could grow.
There's a way to monetize a network outside of strictly renting the spaces. So strictly renting the spaces, I think, is like the core product. That is what generates all of the activities downstream, but that's the top of the funnel, right? So we have to, I had to start telling a story that was going to show investors how not only this would grow as a core product, but also how we could layer more services on top of it, like what Uber did with their transportation network. They started adding Uber Eats and Uber Rush and all these different ideas that you can easily layer on top once you have the core product.
Uber Pool, in fact, is one.
All these different things. And so that's what I started pitching. That was the main difference. And when I started doing that, I saw a massive uptick in interest from investors and votes in the launch accelerator.
Fantastic. And then at some point, you were able to raise more money. Let's go through that process.
So from a candid standpoint, you and I had talked about it with the syndicate. And
Syndicate.com, for people who don't know. Companies that come through the accelerator, if they're in the top couple of high performers, not just by votes given by other VCs, but in our judgment of our team, which typically means revenue is growing and we see it being able to get to 100 million in revenue. So you and I talked, hey, you guys are breaking out. There's something here. And what happened next?
Yeah, so we worked out a deal with the syndicate. So we did, instead of, I think what the usual pathway is for a launch company is to go through the accelerator and then do the syndicate. We actually did the syndicate during the launch accelerator, which was a lot for me to take on, but it was the right thing because our timing was good, our traction was good. I was already spending so much time in front of investors. It made a lot of sense just to get that syndicate process underway.
You
and
nailed
to take
the
advantage.
Pitch already.
Yeah,
you had all the data cleaned up. You had clean books, accounting.
Correct.
And you had answered all the hard questions.
Yep.
For what, 6, 7, 8 weeks?
At that point, yeah, I was halfway through the accelerator. So we did the syndicate and we raised $800,000 and then you guys put another $100,000 in on top of that. So the syndicate brought in $900,000 and that was, we had actually found a way to kind of pare down our seed round to say, we can get everything we need to get done for $900,000 and then hopefully quickly get to a Series A with this money. Put this capital to use. Let's get back to the product. Let's go heads down and see what we can do with this $900,000.
Because you were kind of in the break-even range.
Yeah.
Maybe burning 10 or 20 a month.
Yeah.
Something de minimis.
Yeah, exactly.
In our world, de minimis, not in the real world.
De minimis because we had no other capital. And so when this capital came in, we said, well, great. If we spent $900,000 as capital efficiently as we have been, we could potentially double or even triple the size of our company with this just $900,000. And so that was the plan. We did that, had a successful syndicate. We had 147 investors in the syndicate put in. So it was around a $5,000 check on average.
And if you were explaining to another founder how the syndicate worked, describe in broad strokes what the process is.
Yeah. So the process, I would actually ascribe similarly to Kickstarter in some sense. So you basically, you put out a deal memo with launch. You come up with like the pitch. It's all in written form. You have all your financials ready. And then you go out and you say, great, we are opening up our company to sell shares. Well, it's a safe note, but we are opening up our company to launch syndicate investors, and these syndicate investors have the chance to hear you pitch for, I think I pitched for 40 minutes and then did 20 minutes of Q&A. So it's a live process that people can log into from around the world. That deal memo goes out in advance so people can read through your company, see if they have interest in it. If they do, they can then quickly jump into your pitch. And so that was also recorded and then distributed afterwards. And so
The
webinar went out.
How many people showed up for the webinar about?
I believe it was maybe 180 or something like that.
Was that the RSVPs or showed up?
I can't quite remember, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
And
so people know by context, we have, at the time you did it, I think we had 2,900 syndicate members. I think we have 3,200 now. Mm-hmm. And of those, at the time you did it, maybe 12 or 1,300 had done a deal already.
Sure. Yeah.
And now it's 1,600 have done a deal.
Wow.
So if 180 showed up, that would be about 10% of the base of the 15% of the base of active investors at that time.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Which pretty impressive.
Yeah. So we did that webinar, did the deal memo, and that went out to all the syndicate members. And then basically they have a chance to commit any amount of capital they'd like to. I think there's a minimum on it.
I think 2,000 was the minimum for that 2,000. Deal. Because we can have up
That's
to
right.
250 members. And they're all in one SPV, special purpose vehicle.
Yep.
So they're one item on the cap table controlled by me, Jason Calacanis. I make the decisions for that group of investors. Yep. I work with the founder. You don't have to work with those 147 people directly.
Right.
But you can.
Yeah. And
you don't have their names.
That's right.
You have an email. You can email them blindly if they want to uncloak. They can. Or if they are sort of more passive investors and just want to read your update and not have you emailing them direct, they could choose not to, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, and you guys set the terms, so you set the cap rate and all these different things, and so it made it really easy for the syndicate investors just to either jump in or jump out, just like you would be supporting a Kickstarter campaign. So we had 147 people, like I said, commit capital to the round on average that equaled out to like a $5,000 check, which was amazing. And then, so once we got that capital in the bank, we went back to work and we were finishing Launch Accelerator still. And kind of halfway through, I was like another two.
Towards the end.
Yeah, it was like another 2 weeks after the syndicate. We went on kind of the
little
the
trek.
Tour. Yeah, a little trek.
We do a little trek.
Yeah.
We made a trek to my friend David Sachs's firm, Craft Ventures.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and his team looked at the presentations, the seven. And did he pick you as his number one?
I believe so. I don't know.
I think some of the other team members also did.
Yeah.
So he liked the business. And then immediately afterwards, he asked to just have a quick meeting.
Mm-hmm.
What did David Sachs, for people who know, worked at PayPal, Zenefits, created Yammer, sold it for $1 billion, and now has a pretty amazing Craft Ventures here in Silicon Valley. He's also a notable angel investor. What did Sachs say to you about the business? What did he like about the business?
I think what got him really excited is that their thesis is centered around physical virality. Mm. So they've invested in things like Bird, SpaceX, Cloud Kitchens, you know, these physical
Cafe X,
these physical products that impact the real world and that consumers can interact with in real life. And I think that thesis that they have at Craft Ventures lines up really well to obviously what we're doing. And we are, of course, going to build a software platform and a marketplace on top of what we're doing. So it's not just renting these venues, but the core product of what we're doing is enabling convenient and affordable access to space for people to gather in real life. So that, I think, really resonated with David and the Craft team. And they saw what you saw, which is, when you have a network of spaces that are very convenient and very affordable and very easy to use, then and you've got people coming and using them for all types of things, you're capturing a lot of attention, a lot of foot traffic, a lot of it's just a really amazing way, I think, to catalyze community.
Hmm.
And so David saw that, and I think he saw the ability for this to scale and the virality that we have inherent in our business is something similar to what a lot of the things he's invested in the past with. So if you think about one of our events, for example, if you bring tomorrow 50 people to our mission space for your live podcast, the chances of, you know, 10, let's say 20% of them are founders who have companies who need space for offsite meetings or leadership retreats or happy hours. 10% of them might be investors. They're there because they also want to do LP meetings.
They come and there's a neighborly in the window.
Yep. And so, so like that, the virality of you bringing 50 people to our space, even if we don't make that much money, we're not trying to gouge you on the idea, because that's not, the whole point is how do we catalyze you to do something in our space?
Yep.
And then how can we help you make that happen? And then whatever happens down the line, we can find other ways to monetize that that are going to help support the space. But we want to make sure first and foremost that that it is as easy and affordable as possible to get together. And so the virality of that, of you bringing 50 people and then the chances of one of them wanting to book our space in the future for something is very high. So
which, that, for people who don't know, if you see a Bird scooter going by,
it
has the word Bird on it.
Exactly.
Or you see one in the street, or you go by Cafe X, you see somebody getting a coffee from a robot,
yep.
or you get in an Uber with somebody and they rate the driver with you as they get out, or they order the Uber and tell you it's 3 minutes away. Now you know what that is. When we get back from this quick break, we're going to give a special offer for Neighborly from Jason when we get back on This Week in Startups. If you work in Silicon Valley and you work in technology, you know it's not all about ping pong tables and free food and the hoodies. Those are all fun, sure. But there are a lot of challenges throughout the startup journey, and no one understands them quite like our friends at Silicon Valley Bank, where I do my banking personally. Have a great idea for a startup, and I do it professionally actually as well. If you have a great idea for a startup and you don't know the right way to launch it, well, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of startups and is always eager to share their insights. Feel like your company's growing at quantum speed? Well, Silicon Valley Bank strives to support you at your pace, quick, nimble, and always looking ahead. With Silicon Valley Bank, you're not just getting a bank. You're getting a banking and financial services partner, along with the insights and experience and scalable solutions that founders need to move their bold ideas forward faster. I know this because I work with Silicon Valley Bank, and I have for over a decade. And when I email them, man, do I get a quick response. So here's your call to action. If you're a founder, a potential founder, or just someone with an idea and a whole lot of ambition, Silicon Valley Bank has solutions that will help support you from the seed stage to the big stage. So visit svb.com/next to learn more. Silicon Valley Bank. Ideas. Bank here. All right, welcome back. We teased a Neighborly offer. Here it is. If you email Jason, that's my name, at Neighborly, N-E-Y-B-O-R-L-Y.com, the first 100 people or so who email that will get a $100 credit for when they use a Neighborly, which is only in the Bay Area and Oregon now, right?
Yes.
Got it. So that's a hundy, which gets you basically your first hour. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do something for 2 or 3 hours, I guess that would be pretty good. Is there a minimum number of hours?
There's no minimum, no.
You can do it for 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
So literally, if I wanted to just have a quick presentation,
mm-hmm.
I could just go for 1 hour and do a half hour presentation and then leave.
Yeah.
And you have a projector there,
yep.
you have chairs there.
All the AV equipment.
Do you give people setup time, or they have to pay for the setup time?
They have to pay for the setup time.
That makes sense. It's so mm-hmm. cheap.
Yeah.
Is there a day rate that's discounted?
We haven't come up with that because we really like the, just committing to the hourly model. It just really makes sure that you're, if you're using it, you're paying for it. If you're not using it, you're not paying for it. There's no cognitive
dissonance. What if I wanted to do a 2-day event?
Yeah.
Would I have to pay the 48 hours, even though I overnight might be leaving my stuff there? It's like a 2-day pop-up.
Yeah, we just have an overnight fee for that. And then we usually give a 10% discount if you're booking more than 10 hours.
So think about that. If you were going to do a pop-up for your startup company,
mm-hmm.
let's say you were doing, Dollar Shave Club, you wanted to do a pop-up
mm-hmm.
in Union Square. You could literally rent it for 2 days
mm-hmm.
for whatever, 12 hours a day, 15 yep. hours a day, get the overnight for free or for a fee.
Yep.
It really cost you like $3,000 to do a pop-up.
Yep.
And you
probably
wouldn't
less, probably
have
like 2,500.
To sign a lease
no.
or anything.
Yep. We have internet, AC, all that stuff. So you're just
perfect.
Set up just, and keep your stuff in
and
there.
I can bring my own food.
Yep.
You have a projector.
Mm-hmm.
You have Sonos there or speakers or something?
We have speakers, yep.
You have speakers.
And Spotify and
okay.
It's all included.
What am I not allowed to do there?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if I wanted to have an overnight rave, or if I wanted to have a dance party as part of my Sweet 16 or whatever, mm-hmm. am I allowed to have a dance party in the space?
Yeah.
People dancing, whatever?
Yeah, you can dance. I mean, the only things that you can't do were things that are illegal in any space, right?
Got
so
it.
You can't smoke inside. You can't do things like
Got
that.
It.
You can't sell alcohol. Like there
can't sell alcohol. No, makes sense
because you need an entire license for that.
Yeah.
So,
but if you wanted to sell tickets,
Yeah.
If I wanted to do a book reading,
yep,
and I wanted to charge $25 and include pizza and do a book reading, I could.
Totally, yeah. We've had people do comedy shows in our space, so like comedy entrepreneurs who want to get out there and they can't afford to rent an expensive venue in the city, they can rent our space, and they brought 40 people there and they sold tickets, and that's totally
yeah, if you get 40
agreeable.
People and you sell them tickets for $25 yeah. each, people, now you got $1,000, you paid $400 for the space.
Yep.
And you include two drinks with it or whatever, yeah. or you just, there's an open bar or whatever, or there's some soda. It's great.
Yeah.
So hypothetically speaking.
That's the idea, because at the end of the day, if you can build a business that people can build businesses on top of, you've got a really, really sticky and strong platform. And so that's also the idea, is I think we're hitting our stride from a professional standpoint, as far as like meetings and things like that. When people are saying, well, I don't yet have the capital or the ability to open my own comedy club, but... And I don't like the way that these traditional comedy clubs are taking 80% of the ticket sales or whatever. So I just want to I want to do my own thing. I want to rent this place, and I want to have full control over it, and I want it to look a certain way.
I just love the fact that money. I can order my own food too. Yep. But in a way, you know what? I just had this like epiphany. You're kind of like an API, like Amazon Web Services,
100%
for space.
Yep.
So you can just plug yourself in. And in fact, you can rent the spaces on PeerSpace and some of those other networks already.
Yep. Yeah.
So you can book through them.
Yeah.
On a geographical basis, how are you going to do your rollout? Mm-hmm. Have you considered franchising, or do you want to own and operate and be what we call an asset-heavy marketplace? And then how do you think about cities versus suburbs versus the country? It does seem to me that the suburbs need spaces too, or am I wrong? And then are you thinking about having... you know, launching 10 at a time per city, or maybe doing 10 cities, one each city? How do you think about a rollout plan?
Yeah, so that's really what we're focused on right now, is to be able to scale this. Clearly, you have to have a city playbook. You need to kind of have a guide that our entire team can follow to be able to open these up efficiently and to have a successful rollout. So we're going to be opening up in LA at the end of this year. And so what we'll be doing in LA is probably opening between 5 and 10 in a 3-month period. And that I think is really necessary, at least to get that kind of like, instant virality. We need to have more than a couple places. So
yeah, some density helps.
Some density, because there needs to be network effects as far as using it and telling other people about it and having a space in your area of LA.
Yeah, this is why I feel you got to do the peninsula here in the Bay Area, because if people are using it in San Francisco, or they use it in Berkeley or in Oakland. And then they go, let's say they work in the city, but then they live in Atherton, Palo Alto, Redwood City, San Mateo, Millbrae, whatever. There should be one on every block, just like there's one Pizza Delfina, or there's one, you know, multiple Phil's, you know, one Phil per neighborhood. There's got to be like one per neighborhood.
Yep. Yeah, I think it can definitely work in the suburbs. My theory is that this may even work in smaller towns, because even smaller towns, I went out last year to South Texas for something, and right on the border, and it was a really small town called Brownsville.
Huh.
And even in that town, they had 5 or 6 event venues, right? And these are, you know, local businesses, and they're working, and they were charging more than $1,000 a day in one of the poorest towns in Texas in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And so that's more than we charge in Union Square, San Francisco. And
you could probably charge $50 an hour down there.
Even less maybe. So
20,
I think,
$30
an hour. So I do think it has the potential to work in a lot of different environments and a lot of different types of places. And the question as far as franchising and kind of like managed spaces, we're experimenting with that and trying to figure out what the different strategies are. We've looked into franchising. We've looked into joint ventures.
Franchising, not a good idea.
Yeah, it's tough.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah, go ahead. I want to hear it.
Then you have to service two people, the franchisee and the customers. And then you have this weird tension with the franchisee trying to extract value and this weird tension that you don't need to have.
Yeah.
Like, there's some massive tension going on between Subway.
I saw that.
Owners and the franchise.
They were trying to tank their franchisees.
So they're sending inspectors out to tank their franchise.
In New York,
it all gets
dirty. Yeah.
You know, Cafe X had the same thing. People wanted to franchise Cafe X. And I was like, you know what? Can we get to 10 machines and then make a decision?
Yep.
You didn't mention Saks. Saks met with you, the team. What happened next?
Yeah, so we met with David Sachs, and they, like we just talked about, they loved the idea of the physical virality. They wanted to get involved, and so we did some diligence with them for a couple weeks, and they came out to see our spaces, and We told them kind of the vision and where this was going to go, and showed them a space that we had just leased, so it was empty and kind of about to get transformed. And then we showed them our existing spaces and really gave them the rundown of how it works in person, which was nice. So we got to know them really well, and they got to know our team. And then they invested $1 million.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. So you get $1 million from us in three bets.
Yep.
The accelerator bet, then another 100 from the fund, and then another 800 or 900 from the syndicate.
Yep.
So that's 900 or $1 million we put in.
You guys did about 900. You guys total. And the syndicate. Uh huh. And then Saks did $1 million.
Got it. With
Kraft Ventures, and then
got
we had a lot of angel investors who wanted to get involved.
Wanted to come in. Yeah. So some of which I'm assuming you met at the accelerator.
Not really, actually.
No, okay. These are people who started to find out.
Word started getting
Saks
around.
Were in.
Yeah, word started to get around a little bit before that. Huh. After the syndicate, really.
Gotcha.
And so what I think is
some people try
about
to
that,
do end runs around the syndicate.
No, not yet.
Yeah, we banned them from doing that.
Yeah, that's
it's a little bit of a problem. Sometimes people join the syndicate and then try to invest directly. Then we just ghost them.
Yeah, it doesn't.
As the kids say,
it doesn't even make sense from a variety of perspectives for a launch founder to.
You were going to say something though about.
Yeah, I was just going to say so that
buzz.
So we had a lot of buzz after the syndicate and.
Because the syndicate goes to 3,000 people, many of which are VCs.
Yep.
And the angels tend to talk to the VCs and say, "I just invested in this. You should check out this company."
And I would be remiss not to give another shout out to another launch founder who has helped us immensely, which is Zach Parker.
Oh,
so Zach actually introduced us once he saw what happened with the syndicate.
Give a plug to his company. Yeah.
Yeah. So for Look Network, it's the best place to book talent in a flash, I think is his slogan.
L-U-K.
L-U-K. Yeah. It's very trendy. Yeah. It's based out of LA, but it's a place where you can book models for your shoots and production needs. Yeah.
How did he help? He put you in touch with investors he was working
with?
Yeah,
Zach's a third-time founder, and so he knows a lot of angels and a lot of people in the technology space and who could really help us with building out our new website and who had capital and wanted to put it into early-stage companies. And so he introduced me to some of the people that invested in him in previous ways and really
helped
me.
That's a nice thing where the cohort helps each other.
It was incredible.
Because you had Meowtel in yours as well, and they were very helpful.
Yeah.
Did they win number one?
They did, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Meowtel did incredible.
Another marketplace/network.
Yeah, exactly.
And what did you learn from her, Meowtel?
I just learned from her. I think everyone in the cohort learned from her how much it matters to be connected to your mission, your product. I mean,
right.
She's
a crazy cat person.
She just exuded cats.
Crazy cat person.
And you believed, like, from the very first week of the launch accelerator when everyone saw her pitch, like, she's going to win.
She came out and dunked on everybody week one.
She did.
It was so clear.
It's
so important that you have that passion.
Yeah.
Because as investors, we're looking at our portfolio.
Yep.
And we see people we invested $1 million in. Who then quit?
Yeah,
and you're like, what happened? I thought you loved cats. I thought you loved having an event space for people to share memories and create them. And they're like, yeah, I thought so too. I'm out.
Yeah,
I want to go back to work at Google.
Yep,
I can't
take
this anymore.
It's so excruciatingly difficult to start a company, especially in this space where there's so much competition and early stage funding is drying up left and right. And so like the ability to have that, to have the persistence and the dedication to make it through when you get declined for the 40th time is really, really difficult. And the only way that you're going to get over that is by actually caring about what you do, loving what you do and exuding that. Because like when you saw Meowtel and you saw the product and what it was all about, and then you saw Sonia pitch it, you realize that like, this was just a manifestation of her, and it was connected. And so that meant that she was going to go as long as this idea could possibly go and probably not give up.
Yeah.
And if I was an investor, I would have invested in her just based on that, because dedication is probably, I think, the most
underrated. Like we should just do a syndicate for her. I think she was waiting to like get metrics in a row, and she had some offers, but I think we should run a syndicate. One of the things I'm starting to learn is like when we spend 12 weeks with the founder, we can see in the accelerator how seriously they take it. And you probably saw this, like we're pretty good at picking people who take it super seriously. Like it's shocking to me how serious people are sometimes.
Yeah.
Like they're really, really taking every week seriously.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is about our organization, but and maybe you have some insight having now gone through the entire funnel. You're an example of somebody who's gone down the funnel we designed, which is like podcast and founder university, lead to accelerator, lead to syndicate, lead to continued investment from the top VCs in the world.
Yep.
And you did that exact. It's interesting how we get people who are serious.
Yeah.
They're just serious and dedicated. Like, they do the work.
One thing I would say about it that I think is a factor in that is that you guys specifically are, because you're a smaller outfit, you have more focus, you commit more resources to the founder. You guys are also more serious and more dedicated to what you're doing than I think a lot of incubators are because of their size. Because once you start scaling the incubation idea, even that starts getting watery and watered down and loses some gusto. And I think
gravitas,
that, like, you guys are very much dug into your own startup, which is Launch. And so that comes across to the founders. And I think you guys set the tone.
It's important.
I can, like, when I watch DeMont work, I'm like, this guy is working fucking harder than anyone else here. Like,
yeah.
This is incredible.
No, he's legit.
You're not just like a pretty face at this thing. You're literally here all the time.
I keep telling people that. They're just like, wow, you have such a pretty face. And I'm like, it's not just that.
It's just the makeup person upstairs. I did that. Yeah.
No, I mean, what I find is the core, how hard I work or how hard I take it seriously.
Yeah.
The group does.
Yep.
So when they see me drill into specific moments in a presentation where I'm like, go to slide 7.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this slide. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh.
People are watching. People are paying
attention. People are paying attention.
You're investing your time into it, which is more valuable than the $100,000 you put into it. It's actually the effort and the sweat equity you guys are putting into the founders. Yeah. I think it's just this like reciprocation process that it's hard to feel in a small group of people. It's hard to feel like you're not going to pull your weight when everyone else around you is busting their ass.
Yeah, it's a
and so there's something good about that. And I would really make sure to keep that if you can in the DNA of Launch because there's a reason.
High expectation culture.
Yeah. If you think about education, right? Like the bigger the class size gets, it's easier to fade away in the back and not have to do anything and no one notices. Mm. The smaller the class size, you can't hide.
No,
and
there's no hiding.
That's kind of like
what there's
you have
a top
going on
three
here.
And then there's the four.
Yeah.
And then you can look at the four and then there's out of the four, there's the two.
Yep.
So whoever's dragging their feet, they're going to be at the bottom and we're going to be there.
Yeah. And right I think if I wasn't going to, if I had the intention before applying, like I just wanted, this is a leisure thing for me. This is something fun I'm doing on top of my job at Facebook or something. And I'm not like, if it works, great. If it doesn't, who cares? I don't think I would have applied here because it's just not the kind of place for that. It's like people here are like, this is make or break. It's do or die. There is no plan B kind of feeling here, which is really great. And I think
we try to optimize for that when we select.
Yeah.
I remember my dad told me about the Army and he said when he got into the Army, there was a guy in the back when they were doing their 10-mile hikes with like a stick. And I said, what was the stick for? He said, in case you slowed down.
Yeah.
Said, what do you mean? If you fell behind, if you were in the front, there was a reward. And then if you fell behind, there was a stick.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's literally carrots and sticks. I was like, they should just literally give the best runner or the best person in the front a carrot. But they had the stick too. And in our example, the stick is, if you're not keeping up, then I'm going to talk to you.
DeMont hits you with his MacBook Pro.
No, it's even worse. You have to sit down with us and talk to us.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's so annoying to talk to me when I'm perturbed.
Sure.
Or when I don't.
I don't
want to
know. I don't want to know how that feels.
No,
I'm going to stay away from that.
I just kill people because I can't. I go mental.
Sure.
When something is not working out, it literally makes me mental. It's like my deficiency in life is that when something's not working, I just it becomes all consuming for me.
Sure.
And that happens with the startups too. If something's not working, I sit. Forget about the founders staying up at night.
Yeah.
There were some founders whose pitches just weren't working, you might remember. Mm-hmm. I couldn't sleep. I was just literally like thinking, why are they not getting votes? Why are people not understanding the idea?
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I just come in, I rip up the presentation, start over.
Right.
Let's go. Let's just redo this. What's the strongest piece of your presentation? Let's just start and go over that. Just on a quick economic basis, is it true that cities are having a retail apocalypse, like I hear on CNBC? Is it best described as an apocalypse or a contraction? Or how would you describe what's happening to storefronts? Because we all live in towns where we see storefronts on a main strip and, 10% of them, the stores are closed.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Yeah, I would say a little bit of that is clickbait. It's the media, obviously, so they want to say something.
They want to say something untruthful.
Yeah, they need to say something that's a little bit outlandish. So I think that you can make a case that it could be an apocalypse, but it's certainly not now. I think that that's a little bit overplayed. What is happening is a slow death. It's slow. It's not an apocalypse.
It's a hospice rather than
nuke. Yeah, it's nothing massive is happening. But I think what you're seeing, and if you dig into any specific subsector of retail real estate, so I'm talking about cafes, restaurants, clothing shops, art galleries. If you dig into each one of those, auto body places, you start to kind of see that there's a lot of weakness in each one of those subsectors, and they're all in the process of being disrupted. And I hate to use that word, but there is a process that's happening for each one of those subsectors of retail that is concerning. And for me, when I look at it, I think that if you project that that disruption out another 10 years or even 5 years, it might get pretty ugly pretty fast. But
it's gonna
not
get uglier.
It's gonna, yeah, it's just,
there's no way
this
it gets better.
No, this is not gonna reverse. But I don't think it's an apocalypse necessarily. It is, I believe, more in the
slow bleed.
It's a slow bleed, but it's also I believe in the optimistic stance on it, which is that it's a transformation. Mm-hmm. So our economy has already transitioned, right, from industrial and to information and the retail
networks.
To networks. But the retail real estate and real estate in general, you see it with office is transforming with WeWork and co-working. You got the co-living companies like Zeus and Bungalow and all these companies. So you see other types of real estate that's residential, that's office. You don't see it really happening yet in retail real estate. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to a lot of the brokers or landlords, or even city planning officials about this issue, no one really knows what to do about it because it's so multifaceted.
It's acute in, I live in an area called Hillsborough, and it's right next to San Mateo, and we have a downtown area called Burlingame.
Yep.
Burlingame has two streets, Broadway and Burlingame Avenue. And Burlingame Avenue is like the beautiful, bucolic, mm-hmm. Apple store, Sephora, everything.
Yep.
Phil's, you know, Starbucks, Pete's. I think there's four coffee places on Burlingame Avenue.
Yep.
Then you go to Broadway, which was the old thoroughfare. And on next door, everybody's talking about how it is turning into a blight.
It is, yeah. I walked those two streets to figure it out myself, and I was pretty taken aback. I actually had never been to Burlingame, to be honest.
Yeah.
And when I went there, I started at Broadway, and I was like,
what is this garbage
This is Burlingame. This is always what I thought when I drove by on, 101. But no, this was like that street you're talking about, which is the blighted street next to it. And then when I went over to Burlingame Avenue, I was like, oh, wow, this is still very healthy. So it's not like an apocalypse in the sense that all this stuff is getting erased. It's just that like there is this, from an economic perspective, really what's happening is it's actually quite simple. There is a massive oversupply of American retail real estate. So we have, I think it's around 26 square feet of retail real estate per capita in this country.
Wow.
And the average developed nation in Europe, I think, is around 4 or 3.
Wow. So we were just Canada's crazy
around,
consumers for a long
time,
and we needed to have a Radio Shack.
That's correct.
And we needed to have a teddy
bear
store.
We went wild in the 90s.
Color Me
and
Mine.
We just went nuts with the consumerism in the 90s, and we built real estate to reflect that society that we had in the 90s, and you can't unbuild real estate very easily.
No.
And so what's happened is that...
it means like knocking a building
down. What's going to happen is that we're going to contract a lot of these, the big box stores, a lot of, unfortunately, like the suburban type of spaces that were all drive to destination places. You say with malls, there's a lot of weakness in malls too, but like in general, we just have way too much retail real estate per capita. So it's going to have to be, first off, contracted, and second of all, it needs to be repurposed.
It's just for the community in Burlingame that's in that area. They're just like... it's so sad to go to a street where it's literally every third or fourth on Burlingame, on a Broadway, is shuttered.
Yep.
And then it creates like homeless people sleeping in the front of those doorways.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody who's cleaning the front of them. The windows are getting dirty, and it starts to look like the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah. The phrase is blight begets blight. So
blight
begets blight. You literally have a massive issue. And
what
I went to
storefronts go for
those storefronts. So unfortunately, and this is part of the reason why I think it's going to be a quote unquote slow bleed is because cities and landlords don't necessarily want to face this reality. This is happening. And so
they won't lower prices.
Yeah. People are refusing to adjust to reality. And so the prices are still way too high. And
what is retail cost in San Francisco and the peninsula per square foot per month?
Yeah, it depends on where you are, obviously.
Sure.
In San Francisco, Hayes Valley versus Union Square versus SoMa, but we shoot for spaces that are, you know, between $4 and $5 a square foot per month.
So $10,000 a month in rent or less.
Yeah. And that's about, I would say that's a little bit below average.
Got it.
For San Francisco, perhaps. It's around six, I think. But, but you know, there just needs to be a come to Jesus moment as far as cities and landlords just accepting the fact that your American Apparel store is not coming back. Your flip-flop store is not coming back, unfortunately. Right. All these different things.
It's like the city of Burlingame now has all the retail locations that are empty.
Yeah.
And they're taking those locations and trying to sell them into retailers.
I saw that on their city website.
I went there. Lobbying people to take spaces.
I was like, this is not...
It's bonkers. But they won't... Don't they understand? It's a marketplace. If you lower the price, then somebody might, an entrepreneur might say, you know what? I'm going to try something.
Yes, correct.
But right now, the entrepreneurs are not going to say they're going to try something. And literally, they're putting signs in their windows like, we love serving the community, but we can't... We're losing money and we're working harder and we give up.
And a lot of it's over leverage. So you've got a mortgage on that building or whatever else, and you can't even afford to rent it for less than your mortgage is.
Oh,
and there's all these issues going on. So like when people bought these buildings in the late 90s, mid 90s, and they said, this is only going to go up. And then all of a sudden this starts happening with the changing retail landscape. Now, like, you're either just holding on to it because you don't want to do anything and you're just lazy, which is unfortunately the case for a lot of landlords. They just could not be bothered.
Yeah.
Second of all, it's greed. And third of all, it's just that there isn't demand for those spaces.
Yeah.
And so it's the three facets. And actually, I'm speaking from experience from this conference that I went to in Boston, actually, at the end of May. It was called Exile on Main Street. And it was put on by a couple, which is a pretty sultry title, but it was intense. It was 50 people from government, 20 landlords, I believe, and 10 entrepreneurs, all from the Boston area, Cambridge, and different kind of cities. And they were all coming together to try and figure out what to do with the issue that you're talking about, which is like these blighted streets are turning into blighted neighborhoods and really affecting a lot of different things. And what can we do to figure this out? And what I presented at that conference as Neighborly being a solution for some of these streets or these storefronts. And obviously we are right now a small solution to helping that, but we are a solution and we are thinking about things differently, which I think is the main point of it. But what we came out of from that conference with was the fact that like this problem has to be solved by these three stakeholders. It has to be a combination of city zoning and planning, landlords, and entrepreneurs. And we have to come together in that kind of a fashion that we did in Boston to talk about what are the entrepreneurs putting out there? What do the landlords, how can they adjust to this reality? And then how can the city facilitate those transactions? Because the permitting and the zoning is a nightmare. And the reason we're not in Burlingame is because what we're proposing to do doesn't fit into the 10 types of businesses that existed in 1999. Unfortunately, and they're trying their hardest. And I've looked at their website, and
so
they're doing some proposals.
It's not in their wheelhouse.
Yeah, not really, because it doesn't fit. Like, it's not a restaurant, it's not a cafe, it's not a clothing store, it's not an office.
What goes on that street?
Yeah, the city does.
Really?
Yep.
That's so overreaching and weird.
Yeah.
When
that's
about American freedom and society, that a town gets to determine who uses each storefront for what. Do you think, where did that come from? And is that legitimate? And could you fight it in court?
You'd have to fight something that's been going on for 100 years, but maybe longer. But I think that zoning, it's basically urban planning. Urban planning is really critical, because if there was no urban planning, everything would just be a Google office.
Ah.
Right? So like we have to have some parameters on how commercial spaces can be used. Otherwise,
what happened in Palo Alto, Palantir and Google were buying every office up and down University.
Yeah.
Or any space,
right?
But they wouldn't let them buy the storefronts.
Yeah, because it would shut down the whole neighborhood if everything was a Google office. And so not to single out Google, but anyone who could take a lot of space in an unfettered manner with no limitations will turn our neighborhoods into tech offices.
Yeah.
And in San Francisco, for example. And so that's something that we have to be cognizant of, while at the same time understanding that specific zoning, really restrictive zoning, for things like against what we're doing, for example, it's not even against it. It's just like unclear. cities, I think, just have to come to the table and say, great, like London Mayor Breed is doing a fantastic job with this. She's come out with something called flexible retail, which is allowing stores like a barbershop to sell coffee and a coffee shop to have an art gallery and an art gallery to be something else, like a co-working space.
Less some innovation.
Yeah. Yeah. And so previously you could only have one business license for a space and you couldn't do this multi-tenant, multi-concept kind of idea. And so there is innovation happening. And I think I'm really optimistic after going to this Boston conference, like the cities are going to figure it out and they're going to adjust. It's just that this stuff takes years to undo and untangle. And so I think we'll start to see it when this hottest economy we've ever had does slow down at some point, which will happen. It's going to expose a lot of festering wounds that are only being covered up right now because the economy is so hot. Once this economy turns,
I wonder if this is
it's going to get really bad.
Do you think this has any chance of being that retail has a chance of being a black swan event or commercial real estate?
It could be. Yeah. I mean, it's really up in the air because I don't think anyone is, like I said, facing the reality of it. But once the economy turns and a lot of people close up shop, it's going to get ugly really fast. And so at that point,
because they're just not going to be able to keep up with the rent.
No.
So if you lost, had a contraction of, let's say, 30% on consumer spending
at those
stores. Even
20%, yeah.
Even 10 or 20. Uh-huh, yeah. Let's just pick 15. 15% consumers are scared because the stock market
restaurants,
loses
cafes, everything.
30%. What will happen?
It's going to be bad.
And it's going to be bad because those are just hanging on by their teeth.
Yep. And so what I think will happen then at that point, because that is going to happen, is that the cities will come back to the table and they will, and towns even too, are going to propose more flexible, less restrictive zoning and more kind of entrepreneurial and innovative uses that allow people to do things that maybe in the past we were like, oh, we don't want someone to have a... we don't want someone to do pop-up shops here because that's not a permanent use, not good for the neighborhood. Well, whatever is active and positive is going to be good for the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Let's let it happen.
What if you had a pop-up shop that had 26 different tenants during the year?
That'd be amazing.
It would be amazing because every time you go by, you're like, oh, wow, look, they're doing bathing suits for summer. Oh, look, they're doing whatever, back to school. Oh, look, they're doing art.
Yep. And so that's kind of what we're doing. So we want to be able to utilize real estate in that way to make it more flexible, to make it... basically not, I wouldn't use the word on demand, but really convenient upfront pricing as affordable as possible so that
you don't have an app yet though.
Catalyzes, not yet. So it catalyzes all these uses. Ooh. Yeah.
That's what use of proceeds is going to be with this round.
It's going to be a new website, a new booking platform.
Yeah.
And then
booking's critical.
Yeah. So
will I be able to invite guests through the platform then? Like Eventbrite or Airbnb does?
Yeah.
That'll be the big one.
You'll have a multi-user interface so you can be like Jason and DeMont and Sam can book a space in Boston together and you can all see it in your
platform. And then we add the attendees and they get a notification through Neighbourly.
Correct. You can send them an Evite or something like that. So there's a lot of ways that we can, you know, continue to improve this business with a software perspective because right now we're no code business. It's Squarespace.
Wow, that's so amazing.
It's Squarespace.
You built $1 million no code business, no developer.
No.
Just using Squarespace and Typeform or whatever.
Just upstairs.
SurveyMonkey.
Just upstairs before this, I was updating the website to make it so that people could put the promo code.
Use the promo code TWIST for Squarespace.
I did that, and I don't even know what I'm doing.
10% off on any domain. I don't know if they're an advertiser on this episode, but that is amazing when you think about it. You do a Squarespace
site is incredible.
For $25 bucks a month and you're done.
Yeah, I built the website. I don't know what I'm doing. 2 years ago, it's been upgraded by our head of design, but we still operate with just Acuity, email, Google Calendar, Google Suite, and Squarespace, basically. We've
all
tied all those things together
in
Zapier, and all of a sudden you got like, you all got a company that works and you can find funding and,
all right,
and operate.
Ben, for my Patreon audience only, you and I have had the discussion getting to $100 million in revenue. We're currently just over $1 million in yearly revenue. But you and I need to get this company to $100 million. And do you know the reason why we got to get to $100
million? Because
it gets me my seventh unicorn. And that's all that matters.
I figured it had something to do with you,
The number of unicorns in my Twitter bio is how I dunk on the world. So I need you to be number 7, 8, or 9. Superhuman and Fitbot and Blockable.
What's the character limit on the in the...
Oh, I'll just open a second Twitter account. Don't worry about it. I'll just start putting... anyway... What's your plan to go from 1 million to 10 and 10 to 100 million in order to get me another unicorn? Go.
So.
So It's going to be so magical in 4 years. When this becomes a unicorn, I'm pulling this video out and all those videos of you awkwardly presenting at the accelerator.
You got to trash those ones. That was
no. Au contraire, mon frère.
Oh,
that's editorial
gold. Me in a
goal.
Full suit down here?
You in a full suit.
Yeah.
Just
sweating
not
it out.
Being able to answer the most basic questions right. about your business. Completely embarrassing.
What is your name?
It's
going to
be great. All right. Here's the offer. You're at $1 million in revenue. If you double the revenue, you can double the valuation, and I'll give you another $2 million. So when you're ready, I am so excited about your business, I want to put more money in. So you let me know. You double the revenue, triple the revenue, I'll do double the amount of money at double the valuation or whatever. Maybe even a little more. Who knows? But I am ready to watch this business go from $1 million to $100 million. I predict you'll do it in 5 years or less. I think the trajectory will be 1 million this year is what we're looking at.
No, at least three this year.
We'll do three this year.
We did, yeah.
Okay.
We're already at a 2 million run rate.
We're at a 2 million run rate right now. Yeah. Okay, so let's say 2 million run rate. I think next year you get to what, five, six? Six.
Sure. I think six at least.
Yeah, so let's say seven. Seven in year two. Then in year three, 20. Year four, we hit 45.
Yep.
Year five, 100. It's going to happen. I believe it. All right, everybody. This has been This Week in Startups. Thank you to Director Sir Charles. Thank you, Master Nick. Thank you to my interns, Antonio, Peter, and Paige, doing a great job. And thank you to our Managing Director of Education, Jackie, who has made our content the greatest and who is solely responsible for Foundry University and you being here.
Emmy award winning producer.
Emmy award winning, and you are her fifth Emmy. Yum, yum. And she's got a taste of the carry on your deal. So you're going to get a.
Oh.
Yeah. Jackie's going to get one of those houses in the Berkeley Hills.
Jackie might go to the island.
Jackie
That's fine.
House.
Yeah.
Those aren't cheap up in the hills there. All right. I'm not saying anything about a Hillsborough or Atherton house. Take it easy. But
well,
I
thank
think
you guys so much for having me. It was amazing. It was a really good conversation, and I appreciate your whole team. So
and remember, jason@neighborly.com. NEYBORLY.com. You email jason@neighborly.com and Ben will get that email and give you $100 towards your first Neighborly. My God, what if I got you 1,000 people to do that? Would that be good?
Maybe not tomorrow, but
eventually it would be good. Yeah. But you get their email addresses so you could always put them on your list.
Yeah. We'll
and they can use it anytime. All right. There you go.
All right.
We'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.